Voice of Reason Broadcast Network presents The Heretics Hour with Carolyn Yeager. Carolyn Yeager brings you news and commentary on Holocaust revisionism, World War II history, free speech issues, and more. And now, here's Carolyn.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. Thank you for joining me for a special edition of the Heretics Hour. My guest tonight is Germar Rudolf, the well-known revisionist. If you don't know who Germar Rudolf is, please go to germarrudolf.com. That's spelled G-E-R-M-A-R-R-U-D-O-L-F, one word, .com. We are broadcasting this program live on Sunday afternoon, May 6, 2012, because Germar could not appear on Monday evening. Therefore, we're not able to take phone calls, and this program will replay in the regular Monday evening time slot for the Heretics Hour. I won't be reading From the Fire by Georg Friedrich tonight. And one item I want to mention before we begin, because it is important to my Elie Wiesel work, and that is that he is appearing tonight, on Sunday night, which is tonight as I speak, at the Ascentus Center at the Catholic Xavier University. And during the past month, flyers have been distributed at Xavier and at the University of Cincinnati announcing a $1,000 Elie Wiesel tattoo challenge by a Robert Ransdell. And I have the story posted at Elie Wiesel Cons the World blog, which is EliWieselTattoo.com, and I'm going to be following up on Robert Ransdell's news about whatever, anything that does take place during the speech tonight. I think something might take place, but I don't think it will be covered in the news media, except possibly in the Jewish news, which is where we got the first story from. So check it out there on Elie Wiesel Cons the World at EliWieselTattoo.com. After tonight and what's there now. And I want to just say that the University Communication Service at Xavier wrote a blurb about the event, which was probably prepared for them by this organization, the CHHE, and it informed us that a little over a decade ago, Wiesel visited Cincinnati to rally support for the creation of the Center for Holocaust and Humanity Education, and went on and on. Now, this center is sponsoring his speech tonight, so I suppose it's really about more rallying in support of this Center for Holocaust Education and the need for more Holocaust education. We'll find out. But the blurb went on to say, today we are living in the last among the last eyewitnesses to the Holocaust. Soon, living memory will be transformed to history. While we still have the eyewitnesses to teach the lessons of their survival, rescue, and liberation, we should learn from them. This is undoubtedly written by the CHHE. What they're saying is that Elie Wiesel is an example of what they mean by living memory, or I'm saying that, because his memory and the memory of these other eyewitnesses are what is they intend to turn into history. And they're working on that with a lot of enthusiasm. And as the more that we ignore that and say, well, this is just Elie Wiesel speaking again, he's just an old fool, that is to our detriment, because they're moving ahead with creating witness stories to become the future history that we all will have to learn. So I will stop with that now and say more about that probably next week. And now it's my great pleasure to welcome Germar Rudolf. Hello, Germar.
Hello, and thank you for having me on your show.
Oh, well, it's an honor for me to have you. And I have to say that when I sent you a request to be a guest on my show, I really didn't think you would say yes, and I was quite thrilled when you did.
Why is that?
Well, I just thought you might be too busy. You might not want to get on radio programs. You know, you might not be ready for that. It was after I asked you that, and you said yes, that that I learned from reading your blog that you had been on with David Duke already a couple of shows. So, and I think he wants to have you on again, but I'm very happy that I'm one of the first to have you on, and we have a lot of interesting things to talk about because we've already talked a little bit together. So I want to start out by asking you if you have some comments you'd like to make to the listeners before I start in on my questions. I have quite a lot of questions that I'd like to bring up to you, and so I want to give you a chance, so to say, anything you might want to say about where you stand today, or why you're where you're at, what you're doing.
Well, that might come up when you ask me questions. I'd like to comment on your introductory speech on Eli Wiesel, if you're
good.
Ready to do that.
Yes.
And the general concept of those survivor organizations recording, or kinds of organizations, academic organizations, public organizations, recording survivor testimonies all over the world. And I must say, I heard from what you said, I understand that you're worried about that. But I, as a scientifically oriented, scholarly oriented revisionist, am actually ecstatic about it, because this stuff will be in the archives, and eventually it will be publicly accessible, and publicly accessible to us too. And a lot of the things that those eyewitnesses record there will be a treasure trove for us revisionists to prove our point. In many regards, because not all witnesses lie, and not always all witnesses get it always wrong. And on the other hand, the absurd and the obviously wrong parts of it can be easily exposed. So I think that's actually something that's good. Because if you look into history, human history as we have it recorded, comprises now some 2,000, 2,500 years, maybe even more. Nothing of it depends on living survivor testimony. So in the long run, the history of this era of the Second World War, this chapter of the Second World War, will have to be written and will have to be understood without eyewitness account. And what remains standing then without them will be what future generations will learn. And I think a lot of revisionism will be going on for decades to come. I'm looking forward to it because it's an exciting process.
Well, I understand that, but I'm just coming from a position of extreme caution, because we can correct the history if we're allowed to. But it appears to me that this proliferation of Jewish organizations, which you stated so well, and what they're doing and how they're accumulating all this, all their own side of the story. It may be that if they become more powerful, and they are very powerful, they're very powerful. I didn't go into some of the things that, the universities that they control, but, you know, it remains to be seen whether we continue to be able to speak out, even in to the extent that is being done now. It remains to be seen whether there will be a free internet in the future. So that's kind of where I was coming from. But if you're more optimistic, I know that, than I am.
Yeah, you always have to be upbeat about things as you give up.
Yes, okay. Well, thanks for those comments. Anything else?
No, let's jump right in the middle of it, I would say.
Okay. Well, you know, the thing is, how do you prefer to be identified now? Do you accept being called a Holocaust revisionist? Do you prefer not to be called that? Or what kind of label or would you give yourself, or do you not want to have any?
Well, the last statement is probably the best one. I'm a human being. I'm a father. I'm a husband. I'm a stay-at-home dad. And that's my primary occupation right now. I'm not associated to anything or anybody. And the professional work I'm doing right now on the background database programming and database and website administration is should not be considered revisionist work, because what is revisionist work would be research and publishing activities. And I've been out of that, and I have not gotten back into it after my release from prison, simply because other people have taken over and doing a good job. And right now I'm in the niche I'm in, and it has little to do with open revisionist publishing or research activity. So it would be a little bit misplaced to say I am Holocaust revisionist, even though I understand in the public, once you have been branded that way, you're stuck with it for the rest of your life. Probably everybody keeps asking you the questions. And as you've seen on my blog, I do answer them. I voice my own opinion about current events that in some way affect me or things that I'm interested in. So I'm not completely away from the topic.
Okay. You are, I think that you are politically conservative. Is that true, or is it still true? Are you becoming, are you moving more toward the left, or do you still consider yourself a conservative?
I have a little bit of a problem with that, with these terms, liberal, conservative, this and that. The problem is that I've lived in so many countries, and these terms mean completely different things in different countries. Therefore, you always have to give me the framework. What country are you talking about? I assume, of course, you're talking about the United States. And looking at the average conservative in this country, I would say I've never been a conservative in terms of a Republican. So it's I wouldn't fit into that.
But in Germany, I'm thinking in terms of when you were in Germany before you got into so much difficulty there. You were conservative in your university days and so on, considering Germans being right.
That's correct. Even though you need to keep in mind that a conservative in Germany is a completely different thing than a conservative here in this country. So it gives you a little bit of a misunderstanding to say, I'm a German conservative. In Germany, you can't be a patriot. As a conservative in this country, any politician in the United States who wants to have success needs to be a patriot. Any political person in Germany who wants to have success needs to deny patriotism. So these are the worlds in between, I would say, in Germany. Politics in some regard are upside down to what we have here in the United States. So it's incomparable to a large degree.
Well, let me put it this way. I do recall you saying about your younger days. I don't mean when you were a child, but, you know, when you were in college and afterwards, that you thought the best period in Germany was during the monarchy.
Yes, that's true. Yes. But you wouldn't find that among the political conservatives in Germany. Monarchy is a taboo issue.
So, who are the political conservatives in Germany today?
They don't exist.
That's what I thought.
Yeah, the Christian Democrats refuse to be called or call themselves conservatives. They don't want anything to do with it. And there is basically no political movement that can call itself conservative of any relevance. There have been attempts of establishing some kind of movement or political parties, but they all get squashed. They get ostracized. They get labeled as Nazi movements, and they get destroyed that way, either outright outlawed or persecuted to the point where they just dissolve and disintegrate. So, being a conservative in a common understanding in Germany is basically an underground activity.
Well, let me ask you this then, if I hope you don't mind. Are you a nationalist? Or as opposed to being internationalist?
Yeah. I used to be a German patriot. Yeah, German patriots are homeless, politically speaking. Nationalist depends again on how you define a nationalist. I used to have a definition to distinguish a patriot from a nationalist. And the line that separated is that the nationalist would further the good of his own country even at the expense of other countries and nations, and this is something I wouldn't want to do. Now, a lot of people would disagree with that definition, but I have seen nationalists all over the world who do exactly that. And a patriot, however, recognized that any other person in another country and any other national has the same right to patriotism and actually thinks that it's a good thing for everyone to be patriotic, even those people beyond the border, so they respect each other.
Therefore, I would... Go ahead. Sorry.
So I prefer the term patriot rather than nationalist for that reason, but that's my own definition.
A patriot would put his own country first, wouldn't he? I mean, there's a difference between putting your own country first and seeking to take advantage of other countries in order to help your own country, you know, take advantage of them in a harmful way, right? So, right. So I'm just saying, you know, that. And I think of a nationalist generally as a not a little more than a patriot, because they are you are believing that nation states have a right to determine what they should be doing for themselves, and they shouldn't have to answer to anyone else.
Yes, but don't patriots do the same thing?
Well, yeah, yes, it could be, they could be.
So either there is a difference between patriot and nationalist, and we need to define it, or there isn't, and then it's pointless distinguishing it. So since it's two different terms, there must be a difference, and I'd rather stick with the patriot rather than the nationalist.
Okay. Now, you've written from childhood that from childhood you had a greatly overdeveloped sense of justice. Can you say a little about that?
Well, that's something that my mother claims, and I think in the meantime, I believe it myself. And the primary reason why I do that is because I have my own children. I've seen my own children grow up and have the same struggle of an extreme sense of justice and injustice and fairness and unfairness done to themselves, done to their environment, and reacting accordingly. So I've seen them grow, and I've recognized myself in them and came to understand what my mother was saying. So as a child, of course, your perspective of things aren't always balanced. Therefore, what you consider to be unfair or unjust is not necessarily true. But having extreme reaction to subjectively experienced injustices has been something that I've exhibited in childhood. And this kind of emotional reaction to perceived injustices is a part of my personality that it's just inside of me. It's a part of me, and I can't deny it, and I won't be able to do anything about it. You can hear that phone call.
Yeah, what is that noise? Do you know?
It's just somebody calling here. So it's
that's your phone.
Okay.
What do you have to say, Germar, about justice for Germany? I would like you to address that, if you would, please.
Well, justice for Germany, two concepts, justice in Germany, both are not properly defined, are they? Well, everybody has a concept about justice, I assume. When it comes to Germany, the whole thing starts with the way the Second World War has ended. And if you look into it, the powers who went to war against Germany, and including Germany, they all had signed certain international treaties that define what they are allowed to do in case they conquer foreign countries. So England, France, and the United States have been signatories to that treaty, like Germany has been. I don't know about the Soviet Union. They may have bailed out of it. Like they bailed out of everything. But these three countries at least did. And what they did after the war with Germany was in extreme violation of that treaty. Basically, what it says is the right to self-determination needs to be granted. If a war is over, it's over. A peace treaty must follow, and you cannot change the constitution of a country. You cannot change the consistency of a country. You cannot change the territorial integrity of the country, and so forth. Now, of course, every single point that I just made was violated, was ignored by the victorious powers. Germany to this day has no peace treaty. The United Nations Charter to this day defines Germany as an enemy state of the entire world. These chapters, it are chapters 53 and 100 and some odd, are still in the book saying that the Allied powers may resume hostile activities against Germany without any further ado if Germany picks up any kind of revisionist or revanchist policy, revengeful policy. These are terms that aren't well defined. And so it goes on. If you look into German situation today, the Federal Republic of Germany, like the former communist East Germany, has been created by the Allied powers. It is, initially it was not fully sovereign, then the sovereignty increased stepwise. The first one was in 55. And then after the reunification in 1990, Germany got a little bit more of sovereignty, but still it has no peace treaty. And some of the chapters that Germany signed in 1990, the reunited Germany, was that they voluntarily agreed that many of the special rights that the Allied powers had reserved for themselves as occupational powers in Germany after the war are still in effect, basically that the Allied forces, French, British, and American, stay in the country, stay occupational power, can do kind of as they please in the country, which basically means that the occupation of Germany by the Western victorious powers has been eternalized to some degree. So yes. What is with Germany today? After the war, the surrogate constitution of Germany, the basic law, was established under the auspices of the Western victorious powers. And the Germans knew that they don't have self-determination, even though it was in violation of international law. They couldn't help it. They needed to get the boat afloat again so that the German people could survive and think about getting independent later on. So they put it into that surrogate constitution. Once we are reunified and liberated, this basic law becomes obsolete, and the German people votes for a new constitution. In 1990, when we had reunification, the German parliament, with simple majority, decided, well, we just get rid of this paragraph in the basic that basic law, and pretend that from now on what we had temporarily is considered the permanent constitution, and we won't have the German people vote for a constitution. We just continue business as usual. So they basically violated their surrogate constitution by changing it as they pleased. So what is Germany today? It's still occupied. It has no right to self-determination, as others do and never had. And the problem is that the German people, in its majority, accepts this state. They, first of all, most may not know about it, but they are happy with it. Germany was economically very successful, and it still is today, relatively speaking, and most people are interested in material wealth and in their wallet being full, and that's the case for the most part for most Germans, so they don't care.
Well, don't you think, don't they know that if they resisted this, that they would suffer again, that they would be in a lot of trouble? And don't you, do you think that the German leaders, the government, those who are voted in, that they are not allowed to do differently? I mean, this is all, who is imposing all of this? I don't, as you say, the Germans don't have the freedom to make any changes, really. So they just adjust and say, this is fine. I realize that, a lot of them may be happy with the situation because what was done there was so extreme that they just don't want to push for any kind of independent existence apart from being a part of the West and a part of Europe, again. Is it really caused by the Germans, or is it caused by the victors of the war?
It's a mutual thing, I think. The one lesson that Germany has learned out of the two world wars is that you better don't rock the boat, or else we are going to get annihilated. Because yeah. That was the plan of the victorious powers. They bombed every major and medium German city flat with the intention of killing as many people as possible. And the Morgenthau Plan after the war was basically, with a few changes, implemented, killing many more millions of Germans after the war. So the Germans knew after that, we better duck, keep our heads low, and not provoke anything or anyone, or else we are going to get an invade.
Well, that's right. Germán, we're almost coming up to our first break, so I don't want you to be cut off. But we'll just say that talking about what you mentioned earlier about the witnesses in the Holocaust, I mean, what they have done to the German people and what they've managed to accomplish there for their own ends, this is what I'm concerned with, is making people, all of us, eventually unwilling and unable to really stand up and resist anything, and we just go along with it. Okay, it looks like we've got just a few seconds, and we will be coming on to our music. And when we get back, ladies and gentlemen, we'll go on to talk about, I'd like to ask you about how your belief in the Holocaust changed, Germán, and when, and so on. And we'll do that when we get back from this break. So stay with us, everyone.
We'll be right back with more on The Heretics Hour. You're listening to VOR, ReasonRadioNetwork.com.
Let's now get more perspective on the apparent encirclement and where it's leading with Jamal Abdi. He is the policy director of the National Iranian American Council, joining me live from Washington, D.C. Mr. Abdi, so the U.S. military is really beefing up its forces in the Middle East in a marked periphery around Iran, going so far as to bring in untried F-22 stealth fighters. Why the buildup? Is it just posturing or preparation?
Well, it's a little bit of both. I think a lot of this, at least, you know, a significant amount of this is reassuring our allies in the region that the U.S. has their back, and that even as the United States appears to be pursuing a diplomatic resolution with Iran, they're also continuing to ramp up some of their contingency planning for potential military operations, and that the military option certainly remains on the table.
What about the second round of talks in Baghdad regarding Iran's nuclear ambitions? Do you believe they'll yield any tangible results?
Well, I think that all sides realize that they need to yield tangible results. And really what is at stake here is that we can't have both sides believing their own rhetoric or being spun by their own propaganda that pressure is working. On the Iranian side, I think they look at the increased enrichment, some of their increased capabilities, as pressure on the United States to negotiate. On the U.S. and European side, I think they view the sanctions as pressure on the Iranians to negotiate. The reality is that only concessions can get the two parties to actually negotiate and come to an agreement. And so the parties need to actually realize that they have to give up some of these things that they've considered as leverage in order for there to be a resolution, in order for this tight rope that is being walked right now, where you have the escalation in military contingency planning, to not become something that spirals out of control and becomes a military option.
I want to ask you about these international sanctions on Iran. Are they entirely aimed at Iran's nuclear program, or do you think it's more of the regime that's a target here?
Well, ostensibly they are, at least in terms of how they're discussed, they're aimed at the nuclear program. But if you actually look at some of the conditions for removing the sanctions, they're aimed at other issues, such as Iranian financial impropriety, Iranian conventional weapons capabilities, Iranian support for terrorism. And so there's a concern that even as we put the nuclear issue at the top of our agenda, that even if Iran complies with everything that we would like for them to comply with regarding their nuclear program, if we're not willing to ratchet down these tensions, these sanctions, in exchange.
Let's return to the Heretics Hour, brought to you by VOR, ReasonRadioNetwork.com. And now here's Carolyn.
Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen. We are now in just the second part of the first hour of the Heretics Hour, which is actually 2 hours. So we have a lot of interesting talk to go. And I'm here with Guillermo Rudolph, my very special honored guest. And I want to ask you now, Guillermo, I read on your website, which is GuillermoRudolph.com, and that's your new website. Your older website is still online, isn't that right?
I don't know what you mean by older.
Well, you had a website that had kind of a yellowish background. I don't know. And you had a lot of things on there. And you had, oh, of course, you have that on this one, too, the story, kind of your biography and pictures of you as a baby and a boy and so on. So I guess you moved it all over. Anyway, I'll just tell people Guillermo Rudolph. We'll just say GuillermoRudolph.com. And you said that you believed absolutely in the truth of the Holocaust until 1989, which would make you about 25 years old at that time.
That's right.
And I just say that's kind of amazing for someone as curious as you are about everything you hear about. But you said it was just like it was something you didn't even think to question. And so how were you taught that, and how do you explain that? How is that done in Germany that everybody believes in it so completely?
It's pretty much the same in the whole wide Western world, I would say. You get fed the stories with your mother's milk through kindergarten and school, so to say. You hear it over and over again. The media are full of it, and everyone that does doubt the story is labeled with all sorts of invectives, like, you know, the names.
Mm-hmm.
I don't need to repeat that. And so, you know, it's just something that you take for granted. And I wasn't much of a rebel until I started studying anyhow. So in my school years, I actually got in touch with an old schoolmate, two decades later, when I was in big trouble, and she said to me, "I never thought of you as a rebel because you were so compliant in school and all sucking up to the teachers." And I didn't see myself that way, but if I look at and my memories and my grades, I guess that was true. So she has been a rebel during school time already, which I remember was the reason why I didn't socialize with her.
So but you were a good boy. You were a good boy doing what you should.
Up to the high school graduation, and when I started studying, things slowly turned around. And there was not even a fact of my studying, because at the university itself, when I was sitting in the lecture rooms and taking my exams and so forth, I kept being a good boy. You know, I wasn't challenging anything the professors were saying. I was just towing the party line wherever it came. No, it was just in my private activities that I started reading books, mainly caused by my father's own history, who had been expelled from East Germany, his whole family. And that was wreaking a little bit havoc in his family and then in my family too, because as a father, he had a lot of psychological issues, which I felt physically, so to say. And so it was not always a happy relationship I had with him, put it mildly. And my mother tried to excuse that with his family's history of having been expelled from his home and going through all this misery in the post-war years. And I wanted to understand, and I happened to end up by chance at a fraternity at the university that itself had been expelled from East Germany. So it had a similar history as my father's family had. And they had a library with a lot of books about German history, right-wing leaning, politically speaking. But this coordinate system at that time didn't mean much to me, so I wasn't judging books by what label certain political directions were putting on it. I was just reading them and soaking them up because they filled a need for identity that I was trying to find, the history of my own family, And then I got into the whole World War II mess that Germany had gone through. And at that time, in the early and mid-80s, it wasn't over. It was Cold War. Germany was still separated. Well, it still isn't over, but it's a different equation today. So I was curious about history, and before I knew it, I had a viewpoint of history in my head of First World War, the time between the wars and the Second World War. That wasn't congruent with what the public was saying and what I had heard in school. And I figured that I was there a little bit on a confrontational course. And it was probably just a matter of time when I would run into material that was skeptical about the Holocaust too. And so it did happen toward the end of my master's studies. And by that time, I had prepared myself, so to say, by having read a lot of controversial stuff and having formed my own independent opinion about things off the beaten media track, that I was ready to take it in, to think it over, and, steer the boat around, so to say.
Mm-hmm.
And the trigger actually was a book by Paul Rassigny, which is considered the founder of revisionism, a former French resistance fighter. He wasn't a fighter, but he was in the resistance, trying to have Jews cross the border to Switzerland, I understand. And he got caught and put into a work camp. And after the war, he was irritated by his former camp co-inmates about the exaggerations and lies they were telling that he knew, because he was there, weren't true. He started writing books about it. And that made it credible in my mind, trustworthy, because I think I wouldn't have trusted a German on the other side of the fence, so to say, who would have come up with a statement like, oh, that's all not true, he's exaggerated. That would have been a statement in self-defense, and I wouldn't trust him. But it came from an inmate, a former mm-hmm. inmate, an enemy of the Third Reich, and that made it trustworthy, and that made me listen. That was the first and most important step to get me to listen.
Yes, well, that's why he did make such a difference, because, he was very credible, and people had to kind of listen to him, and he really turned, he is the beginning of the revisionist movement. Would you agree with that, Rassigny?
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely.
Okay. Well, let me ask you this. While you were still, while you were in high school and you were studying about the Holocaust and the German role in the wars, and did you come to hate Germans or just hate Nazis? Or didn't you hate any of them?
It's not a conscious feeling that you're aware of. You know, if you're in a culture and everybody kind of has the same attitude, it's nothing you are aware of. I compare the attitude that Germans have to themselves with the attitude that Americans have, and I see a huge difference. That it's just a lack of self-confidence that the Germans have in general. They have the complex of feeling guilty for everything. And I remember reading somewhere that somebody made a poll amongst Germans where they were asked who was guilty for a certain war. And actually the story that they were told was completely made up. The question was something like, who is to be blamed for the German-Hungarian War of 1860-some-odd? Now, there was never any such war. The last time the Germans and the Hungarians were at war with each other was, I think, around 900. So it's some 1,100 years ago or so. So there was never any such war. But most people didn't know it, and their historical knowledge wasn't good enough to figure out that this was a trap. But it is interesting how the Germans answered the question. There were some 7 or 10% who figured there is no such war, and they answered accordingly. And then it showed that a vast majority of some 80 or 85% of Germans would blame Germany for in a war that had never existed. Whereas only a minority of the remaining of 5 or 10% would say, no, the Hungarians are to be blamed. And then there were, of course, the smaller minority still who knew there was no such war. Now, if you make a similar poll amongst any other normal nation, the ratio is kind of turned the other way around. If people are not aware of a disaster or crime that somebody, that their nation was with another country, as is normal psychology, you blame the other. Or if I had been the guilty party, I would remember, so it can't have been me because I don't remember, and therefore it must have been the other bad guys. And I think positively by default of my own nation. Anyhow, that's the normal attitude. And so if you ask the French, the British, they say, oh, the others are to be blamed. If you do that in Germany, the Germans blame themselves. And that's the effect that's unique among the nations in the world, that the Germans are ready to take the blame for just about anything. And that hasn't been so before the war. It's something that has been instilled into them by constant propaganda of showing them basically all the bad things that have happened in history have been committed by the Germans. The First World War, the Second World War, even the Neanderthals got extincted in Germany because that's the place where they found last the skeleton. I'm making up a joke here. Mm-hmm. You can carry on. Okay. But yeah, that's what Germans, without being conscious of it, because everybody feels the same, what distinguishes them from other nations. And I learned that only by living in other cultures and seeing their natural self-confidence and national pride and so forth, something that the Germans don't allow themselves to do anymore.
All right. Well, there is the result of what's been done. Now, what would you say to my statement that the same that was done to the Germans is now being done on a kind of a less severe scale, a more, you know, a less short time, more of a long-term plan to the entire European people, including Americans and I'll just say white people, to the white European people of the world?
To some degree, that's true. I mean, the white race has conquered the world, and by so doing, the empire building wasn't always a jolly business. So a lot of blood flowed, and a lot of people were suppressed, subdued, and enslaved in the process. Now, that's over. That's been over for many decades, not centuries, depending on what part of the world you're looking at. But that is being used against today's generations of white people who personally had nothing to do with it, needless to say. But it's still held against them. Any other nation, any other ethnic group is allowed to preserve themselves. I remember a scene in the German parliament some 20 years ago when it was discussed that the Tibetan people are being suppressed by the Chinese. They still do that, of course. Tibet is occupied by China, and China tries to what do you call it, Chinese them? Anyway.
Yes.
Repeatedly, the world community files a process with the United Nations for what the Chinese do. And you have the same thing when there's some Amazon American Indian tribe is fighting for its independence culturally and politically, that there's a lot of sympathy for it. But if you have the same for European people in Europe, some organization there trying to preserve heritage in which way ever, that's then easily outcast as reprehensible, at least, if not illegal, as it happens that many of these groups are being banned in Europe if they cross a certain borderline, either of popularity or of activism that is considered illegal or inappropriate. So, yeah, there is the general thrust. But truth told, it's not really – you have these various stages. The worst hit are the Germans with that. Then come all white people face a similar problem. But then in the long run, with internationalism, with the New World Order, with globalization, all cultural units, all ethnicities in the world face a similar challenge. This whole propaganda of internationalism, egalitarianism, is directed at flattening the whole earth. I mean, we know it's a globe, but they want to flatten it in a different sense to make it one huge market for mass production and easy control. Any border, any ethnic difference, cultural difference is in the way. And that's the way the story goes. So it's a worldwide issue.
Well, speaking then of what do you think is the answer to this push for globalism, internationalism? I mean, if you're other than nationalism, I mean, what can be put up against it? What should people be doing? What would you call it? National diversities or just what's that term we use? Where people determine self-determination for all peoples. But who will make sure that happens? The UN. See here, what I'm getting at is, you know, what's going on in the world today, and who's behind it, and what is the remedy for it?
Well, who's behind it? The general economy. Economic forces are mainly behind it. And then you have, of course, a lot of ideological parties pushing it too, because it's along there. Now, how to counter it? It's a very difficult question. And, to set against multiculturalism, as you have a lot of cultures in one area, you should, start to, popularize a concept of multi-ethnicity. That depends on ethnics actually existing in the first place. It's a matter of, you know, nationalism has the age of nationalism nowadays is identified with national conflicts where nations try to dominate each other and to fight it out with their neighbors. That's something that internationalism claims to be able to overcome, so they're making peace by finally getting rid of all these jealousies and idle matters of pride that people have and they go to war for. So you need to find a way you need to find a concept that allows the coexistence of different ethnic groups and cultures side by side without the conflicts, the borderline conflicts escalating. And I don't know, the United Nations is just an assembly of representatives of today's governments. It's not a representation, a parliamentary representation of the population, of the world population. That needs not to be forgotten. So what can be expected of them? What can already be expected from those governments? Not too much good, if you ask me. I think humanity 200, 300 years ago pushed for the establishing of human rights as an international standard, and has been a century-long struggle to get those human rights, those civil rights firmly implemented in nations and internationally. And what has not been done yet is a similar push of humanity for national and cultural rights of self-preservation, of self-definition, of independence. You know, the United Nations is based on the recognition of each state, I wouldn't even say nation, of each state that their borders are being recognized. But if you look at the borders, how they've been drawn on the world map, most of them are completely arbitrary, and particularly the countries that have been carved up by the colonial powers centuries ago. And that's where conflicts come from, because people have been thrown into one country that don't belong together or feel they don't belong together. And the right, a profound, enshrined in the United Nations Constitution, a right to secede of every ethnic group that doesn't feel home anymore in a country. Be it the Southerners in the United States, they've tried it, they already had the right, but they found out the hard way that they didn't have that right granted. If the Quebecois decide we want to go, the Scottish say we want to leave Britain, whatever part, or the Kurds say we want to leave Turkey, there should be a right enshrined in the United Nations Constitution or Charter for every ethnic or cultural group to secede from the country they are now a part of. And no country should have a right to force them with violence to stay a part of it. I think that's the answer.
Yes, but wouldn't you see a breakup of incredible small little states that can't take care of themselves, that can't survive on their own? Because everybody says, "Oh, we're going to make our own nation," but that doesn't mean they're going to be at all successful in it. It seems like a lot of confusion. And then my other question is, do you really think that humanity can agree on anything? You know, that, well, as humanity, we'll all do this because we'll all be better off that way. Or, you know, it takes a certain amount of giving in to things you don't like in order to do that.
Well, humanity has, over the centuries, forced the rulers to accept civil rights standards. So I'm not saying it's happening tomorrow, but I think just getting another chapter added to the Charter of the United Nations that says, well, now we have civil rights, the next step is we want to have ethnic and cultural rights as well, is something worth struggling for. And as to the point of splintering up nations in many little charters that cannot survive, I would say, well, if they cannot survive, they will have to find a way around that. They have to either cooperate again and establish confederations.
But that's not what happens. They don't do that. They claim themselves to be victims and they want aid. I mean, take an example of Poland when they were, I forgot my exact example here, but when they complain about being taken advantage of, when it's just their own failure to be as successful as they hoped they could be.
So as long as there's somebody paying it, it's fine.
Yeah, well, that's it. you know, because it's all political. And so political issues end up controlling what's going to happen. And also I lost it. I'm sorry.
Never mind. Well, what I'm saying with that is the balance, to find the right balance between government or states as we have them now, countries which sometimes are arbitrarily put together, and a colorful carpet of miniature states. That is a process that has to be found, and it's a process of constant negotiation between the groups and coming to agreements and so forth. And the only way to really find the proper balance is with giving them freedom, keeping all the whole process peacefully, but giving people freedom.
Well, I know what I was going to say, is that if it would end up, as it always does, is that the most advanced cultures, which are basically more than likely white cultures, which are the ones that are under attack right now, are the ones that would be seeing that these human rights and these rights were put into place. Because the rest of the world really has shown itself up to now to be unable to do that, to officiate it, you know, to stand up and make it happen. Because they'll just start fighting amongst themselves. So we end up with the same kind of system that we had in colonial times. What we're trying to do now is pretend that everybody has the right to run their own affairs, but they're needing an awful lot of help in doing so. So, you know, we come to some deeper issues, I think, as to where this all leads if we think that we're going to say, well, we're going to have human rights and cultural rights, which sounds good, but who's working behind the scenes to sort of enforce that at the same time, seeing that they're the ones who are in control of it all? I'm being a little bit conspiratorial, maybe, but I don't think that history shows that this is what can happen. Because I don't think the world, I don't want to get into an argument here, but I don't think the world is better now than it was back then, even though we spout out about human rights and we've got every nation in the world being supposedly having rights that they never had before and trying to have a standard of living that they never had before. But all in all, the whole is getting worse.
Well,
no.
Well, the one thing that I try to make my co-inmates while I was in prison, what I try to make them see is how good our situation is today. Imagine you would be in prison 1,000 years ago in the medievals. Or imagine you would be in prison right now in some prison in, say, in Ghana or in Mozambique or whatever. That would be a nightmare. So now I'm sitting in a German jail, pretty much being taken care of. And even in Germany, 100 or 200 years earlier, prison regime
would have been
much more miserable.
In Germany, but what if you weren't in Germany? You could be much more miserable. And you know what? We're almost ready for the break, but go ahead. There we are. Well, we'll continue this when we get back in about 5 minutes, ladies and gentlemen. So stay with us. This is Carolyn Yeager with Guillermo Rudolph.
We'll be right back with more on The Heretics Hour. You're listening to VOR, ReasonRadioNetwork.com.
From Feature Story News in Washington, I'm Priscilla Huff with The Week in Review. A solution to the case of the Chinese activist Chen Guangcheng appeared to be at hand at the end of the week after Chinese authorities said he could apply for permission to accept a fellowship at an American university. Our Washington correspondent Simon Marks has followed the story closely.
After more than a week during which the U.S.-China relationship has appeared to teeter on the brink of crisis over Chen Guangcheng, both sides have lit upon a solution. Mr. Chen has been offered a fellowship at an American university. China says he can apply to accept it, and U.S. Secretary of State Hillary Clinton says she hopes he will rapidly win permission to leave the country.
This is not just about well-known activists. It's about the human rights and aspirations of more than a billion people here in China and billions more around the world.
So, barring unforeseen twists, Mr. Chen may soon find himself in the United States, and the U.S. will have to begin the process of repairing damaged ties with China. Simon Marks, Washington.
Moscow said it was prepared to use force if the United States went ahead with a plan for a missile defense system in Europe. Our correspondent Anya Ardayeva reported from Moscow.
Chief of the Russian Defense Staff, General Nikolai Makarov, said, quote, a decision to use destructive force preemptively will be taken if the situation worsens. He added that Russia would respond by putting more powerful warheads on its own ballistic missiles if the missile shield is built. Earlier, Russian media reported that Moscow fears that missile interceptors would pose a threat to Russia's security, even though Washington said they're intended to protect against possible attacks from Iran and North Korea. NATO Deputy Secretary General Alexander Vershbo said that Russia's fears of a missile defense shield were, quote, based on some flawed assumptions. Anya Ardayeva, Moscow.
Aung San Suu Kyi has taken up her seat in the parliament of Myanmar, the country often known as Burma in the West. Our correspondent Nathan King reported from Yangon.
There were cheers in front of TV sets across the city as Aung San Suu Kyi entered parliament. After her party won a sweeping victory in last month's by-elections, it's become clear that years of promises of reform from Myanmar's government now seem to be being put into action. The national roadmap envisages free and fair elections in 2015, a new media law, wide-range economic reforms that will open up the country to huge amounts of foreign investment too. There are also plans to end years of conflict in breakaway regions of the country. But for now, Aung San Suu Kyi sits in a parliament where a quarter of the representatives wear army uniforms and most of the civilian members were hand-picked by them. But Suu Kyi's party say they will work with the government. Nathan King, Yangon, Myanmar.
France is holding its second round of presidential elections this weekend. Greece is also voting. From bureaus worldwide, this is FSN.
Let's return to the Heretics Hour, brought to you by VOR, ReasonRadioNetwork.com. And now here's Carolyn.
Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen. I am Carolyn Yeager, and my guest tonight is Geremar Rudolph, and we're in our second hour now. And as we were talking about human and cultural rights and justice for all people and so on, let me ask you, Geremar, where do you think the greatest injustice is occurring in the world today?
Oh, well, there's so much injustice going on in the world, it would be unjust already to just pick one of them and leave all the others out. So no matter what choice I'm going to make now, it's probably not going to be the right one. But I would say if I look at the many conflicts that are occurring in Africa, there's hardly any country where there isn't strife, struggle, war, civil war, whatever going on that continent. And I would say that the profound injustice that causes this all, and I'm coming back to the subject that I've been talking about before, is that the borders on this continent have been drawn by some colonialists along arbitrary lines. They just took a map, drew a line, and that's it. With no regard for cultural or ethnic groups or whatsoever. And the result is what we have today. It just doesn't work. And I think that's the problem of the United Nations. One of the founding principles of the United Nations is that they guarantee the integrity of all the member nations. And that's just wrong, because many, if not most, of the borders, in particular in Africa and Arabia, they are drawn so arbitrarily that they have no justification whatsoever to have the line, borderline going down this way or that way.
Isn't a large part of the reason for a conflict and warfare in Africa due to the African people themselves? I mean, can you get rid of that by changing the borders? You might. And who would determine? How would you determine how the borders are supposed to go there? How many nations would there be in Africa?
No, I don't want anyone from top down to determine anything, and that's the problem. I want to get rid of rulers saying something the way the people have to do it. I want the right for a bottom-up approach of people saying, we're sick of it, we go. And we make ourselves independent, and we don't listen to you anymore as a ruler. Now, that doesn't stop the
rulers from trying
to control
them. Do you think the African people have the ability to do that? The ability to do that?
I know before the colonialists came, they had no states whatsoever. Kind of every village and every small region was doing their own thing, and things weren't as cruel and desperate as they are now. Now, I'm not saying they were in paradise, but it seems to me better to go back to that stage than the mess we have down there right now.
Well, I would like to just leave Africa alone and leave Africans to do what they want to do in Africa. I'm all for that. I don't know what it would turn out to be, but that's the thing. If we expect it to be a certain way, then we're going to try to help it, you know, interfere to make it that way. But let's leave Africa, and let's go on to this question that I want to ask you, and that is, since we're talking about self-determination, how do you feel about Nazism or the National Socialist Third Reich today, as you look at it from your perspective today?
Well, historically seen, of course, National Socialism has been a result of democracy, of the denial of the German people to self-determination after the First World War. And they responded accordingly by voting for a party and bringing it to rule the country that would try to correct the wrongs that the German people felt had been done to them after the First World War. Now, whether or not that is all correct and accurate and fair is not the point. The point is that the Germans felt that way, voted that way, and then went along with their leader who fixed the things in the first 6 years rather successfully before things went sour. And today, National Socialism is judged mainly by what occurred or is said to have occurred during the 6 years of war that the country was in. Now, that's an extraordinary state, and judging National Socialism according to what happened during the war is unfair. I think, because any government that gets between the rock and the hard place that the National Socialists or that Germany has been surrounded by so many enemies, the whole world waging war, being threatened with complete devastation and annihilation, I think no matter what political system you would have had there, any of them would have had to turn rather oppressive and radical and vicious. It's like, you know, any animal that you drive in a corner and threaten to kill, it will go to extreme means, like what Germany did. Nowadays, that's identified with National Socialism, but if you really want to look at National Socialism, what it meant, you need to look in the first 6 years, and that's a completely different picture. That is my view about it. I once had voiced, actually, that even the National Socialists at some point had the idea they come into power, they fix up the German nation, and once everything has been fixed up and it's running smoothly, they've done their job, they quit, and they leave it up to the German people to do again with multi-party parliament and whatsoever. It's the idea that you have found in old Rome. The Roman Empire was built on the idea when we get into a deep crisis, we elect a dictator for a certain period of time to fix the problem. And once he has fixed it, he retires, and we go back to normal parliamentary business. That's before the emperors, actually. It worked for Rome for several hundred years, and the National Socialists had a similar approach. If you look at all the insignia, their ways of doing things, it was built on the Rome of all the things that Rome actually did. The greeting was Roman. The flags and the standards that they used, they were Roman in nature. A lot of the ideas that Hitler had came from Rome. And so the whole approach was along that way, and that's my understanding, that's what they did. Now, coming to civil rights, democracy, and so forth, of course, Hitler used democracy to get rid of democracy. That's something that Democrats don't like, and I wouldn't like it either. But an extreme situation to overcome a tragedy, a catastrophic crisis, it would be an acceptable option, provided when the crisis is over, things go back to normal.
Okay, let me just interject here that if it took Hitler and his methods to overcome the crisis and bring Germany back into a good position, once the parliamentary system went back into play and he was gone, so would everything would go back to the way it was before he fixed it. There's no question in my mind about that.
I would say by 1938, Hitler fixed up Germany, and that's when he should have stepped down and got the system back to normal. He didn't. So the original idea.
Well, in 1938, Germar, the British and actually in Roosevelt were already planning how they were going to wage war and declare war on Germany. They were doing that even earlier. But certainly by 1938, it would not have been possible for Hitler to step down and Germany to be left as it was now, reunited with all these different parts of its land and people that he had brought back together again.
Well, the opposite point could be made because the Western powers, all the powers opposing Germany and trying to wage war against Germany, took, of course, National Socialism, the dictatorship, and Hitler as a justification why such a war would have been necessary. Now, if Hitler at that point would have stepped down, you know, we can't rewrite history. We don't know what would have happened. But seeing that he himself and his party and his way of doing things might actually give justification and make it easy for the enemies to destroy Germany once more should have been an incentive for him to say, okay, I'll give it back to the Democrats.
Well, you know, he did offer. I think it was after he defeated France in those lowland countries. But he did offer to step down even at one point. Maybe that was later. Maybe that was later when things looked worse. He offered to step down, and they wouldn't accept it then because they didn't want to deal with the new German government and give Germany. They wanted unconditional surrender by then. And, in fact,
yeah,
I think they wanted unconditional surrender at the end of World War One. And they didn't get it, so then they still wanted it. So there was really no time that this was going to work out.
Yeah, well, as I said, we will never know what would have happened if that's all speculation, therefore it's to some degree pointless. We can only agree to disagree on this point. So it's a little pointless. It's a futile exercise.
Yes. Well, let's go on to, I've got two things here. I think I'll go though directly to, you mentioned the bad things that all the suffering or whatever it was that Hitler caused or the bad things, how things went so bad, once, or after 1938, let's say. Now, I want to, you have said that, well, I'll have to go directly into the Jews then, because Daniel McGowan said in his article that you have on your front page of your website, that the Jews suffered greatly during the Third Reich is not in question. This is, he's speaking about in revisionism, all revisionists, and you've said the same, that you brought out that the Jews were the main subject of Hitler or the National Socialist cruelty. Do you stand by that? I mean, do you think that's so?
Yes, sure.
Okay. Well, I don't think that the Jews suffered more than any other people. And I ask, why do we have to give them this right?
Wait. These are two different.
But it's been said otherwise too, though. You're right. But when he says the Jews suffered greatly, he's not mentioning anybody else. You know, when we talk about this, they don't mention that anybody else suffered greatly. They might throw in the Roma or the Gypsies here and there, but that's about it. But they don't talk about anybody else's suffering. So it's always focused on Jewish suffering. And the Third Reich is responsible for that.
That's right. That's a monothematic attitude that the world has nowadays. And if somebody criticizes this aspect of history, they take care as a self-protective measure to say, well, I'm not doubting that they suffered. But you're right. Emphasis should be made much more on the fact that they were not the only one. Now, of course,
the Germans ended up suffering more than anybody else except for the Russians.
That is true, too. But then again, the argument goes, the Germans had it coming. They started.
Yeah, of course they didn't. Okay, well, let's go on to this, because I want to get this in. On David Duke's two programs that you were on, April 30th and May 2nd, and they're kind of short programs, but you said in the second program, you said, you were talking about some current news in Germany. You said, I'm so emotionally involved, so passionate about what goes on in Germany. And I was so glad to hear that. I listened to the second program first. And I thought, oh, good, because, you know, I was worried that you didn't care that much about Germany anymore, that you had walked away from it. You were so disgusted with it and you're kind of turned off to it. But then in the first program, which I listened to next, in reply to David Duke's asking you to speak about your motivation to now fight for freedom of speech around the world, which he said this was what you were wanting to do. You said, when I started, it was intellectual and patriotic curiosity as a German. Now the German element has diminished. Now I am more cosmopolitan, mainly concerned with freedom of speech. And you said then a little later, you said free speech has become more dominant for me. So would you say, what do you say about your German identity? And
I didn't say I'm merely concerned with freedom of speech. I said that the patriotic aspect has stepped somewhat in the background, but it's still there. I can't deny my heritage, my upbringing, my identity. It's just within me. I noticed that over and over again. I'm now in this country, in the United States, and I find it very difficult to adjust finding an American perspective because it is still so alien to me.
I wouldn't suggest you did.
Yeah, it's an insular perspective that the Americans have, even though they are not an island, but still, you know, their horizon kind of ends at their border. Everything out there, by language, by culture, by history, is so remote. They have their own perspective, and I Of course, I had a similar attitude. If you just grow up and live only in one country, speak only one language, and have heard things interpreted only in one way, that's just the way you think, and you can't get out of this box. Now, I have lived for the first 35 years of my life doing that from a German standpoint. Now, I got out, lived in England. I experienced the English way of doing things, and the English are very much stuck in World War II, can't get out of it because that's the last heroic deed they think they've done.
Right.
And ever since, it was downhill. So this glorious past is something they reenact over and over again. So that's a weird thing. And then you come to America, live there for a while, and you know, I've lived in Mexico and so forth. So I have a lot of perspectives and can put my own perspective in relation. But still, the formative years of my intellect, of my emotions, they have been German, like they also have been Christian. And I can't get over it, even though I have, you know, it's
why do you want to get over it? Why would you want to get over it?
No, I didn't say I want.
Okay. All right.
But you know, I need distance. That's what I said in my second interview. I need my distance because, you know, you go out with all you have, you invest thinking you do something for your people and your country. And then what happens is that the majority of your people and your country with all its power and authorities go after you like the devil goes after the poor soul, and you're being hunted basically. And after so many years of suffering that, you need distance, emotional distance, or else you just break down emotionally. And that's what I'm trying to achieve by sometimes tuning it out, because I know I can't change it. I just can get myself up in a bad mood, in a depressive mood, frustration, and all the things. If I look at these things, I say, it's all wrong, something need to be done, but I'm not in a position to change things. I have this little aspect that I can tweak a little bit. I don't know down the road whether it has any effect or not. That's all I can do. But the day-to-day politics, trying to get involved in that is such an activity in futility that it just upsets me more than it's worth. So I stay out of it.
But do you think the German people want to do what they're doing to other German people? Or have they been put in a position where that's the way you succeed? And you know, if you're particularly in law, and are these all Germans who are doing this? And of course, a lot of them are, but, you know, I just don't think that this is, you know, now one thing you can say for the Third Reich is that Adolf Hitler's intention was to bring all Germans together, make all Germans respect and care for one another. And I believe that he did that, and that Germans were not harmed, in their own nation, by that government.
Yeah, if you define Germans of Jewish faith as not German, and if you exclude political dissidents, which were put in prison then too, you know, you didn't care
But political dissidents were actually communists, and they did want to bring down the government. I mean, they were very active in a destructive way. They weren't just saying, well, I have a different political idea than you do, like we have, say, here in the United States. It was much more aggressive. And I don't consider, of course, I don't want to offend you, but I don't consider Jews to be real Germans. And they don't either. Or they wouldn't call themselves German Jews. They would call themselves Germans.
Yeah, you can't throw them all in one pot. So you need to distinguish. They're not a monolithic unity. But anyway, be that as it may, that's just the position I find myself in as a German in exile. Two souls in my body. The one that just wants to get out desperately and forgets about it because it's so painful. But why is it painful? If I had dissociated myself from it, it wouldn't be painful. So it is.
Okay. Well, I'm glad it's painful. I am. I'm glad you feel it. I know, you know, let's go on to this. Now you said also, I think in this interview or else you wrote it on your blog, that a person said to you, NS, meaning National Socialism, is Judaism for non-Jews. And you seem to agree with that. I think you were saying you agreed with that. And considering the reason is that Judaism considers itself to be the chosen people, and National Socialists did also, except that, Germar, they did not consider themselves chosen people at all. That's a lie. They only wanted the self-determination for Germany and Germans that you're talking about, saying everyone should have.
That was the second session I had together with David Duke where I referred to that, and you need to listen to that carefully again. And I was comparing the cliché that the world has about National Socialism with Judaism. I expressly said, okay, whether that cliché is true or not is a different issue, and I won't go there. But the general concept that people nowadays have with National Socialism, considering the German chosen superior and trampling on other people and trying to suppress them and deal with them whichever they liked, that is an attitude that Israel now shows to what Palestinians and everyone else that is not Jewish. And then this equation fits.
Yes. You're right. I absolutely agree with that, that this is what people are fond of saying, and it's really taken hold. And it's gone so far as to say that the National Socialists were Zionists and a lot of them were Jews. Oh, there's something I'm going to bring up in a little bit. In fact, we could do that now since it's just come up. And that is that in your introduction to Dissecting the Holocaust, which I kind of took some issue to, which you wrote 18 years ago, but you said that you still agree with it and you're not changing it for when this book is issued again. You used a book by Dietrich Bronder as a reference to behind your saying that, that all the wonderful life that there was in Germany when the Jews were emancipated and you had this Jewish-German symbiosis and so on. And you reference this book by Dietrich Bronder. And Dietrich Bronder wrote in this book, he wrote about the wonderful contribution of Jews to Germany, and he also, though, wrote about, tried to talk very badly about National Socialism, naturally, because he is a Jew and a teacher. He was a teacher. In a school. I don't think he was a professor, but maybe. Anyway, he listed all of these prominent Nazis as being Jewish or having being Jews in their family or marrying Jews or half Jews or full Jews. And I mean, just this whole list. And he's just wrong about every one of them because I did research on it. He's wrong about every one of them except one that's not really here is that Milch. In the Luftwaffe.
Yeah.
So I find this book to be a real, a garbagey kind of book, and I wondered how much you actually looked into it.
Well, I didn't do any research as you did, and maybe that is something I should have done. I took something for granted. Now, I have... I remember when I wrote this paper back in 1994... I had just had made a presentation at the student fraternity I was about the way Germany was unified or reunified the first time around in 1871.
Mm-hmm.
Most listeners may not be aware of it, but Germany had been divided up by its neighbors several times in its history, conquered, reconquered, and so it's a pretty mess in the middle, in the center of Europe. There's always been war there. Every neighbor being jealous. So finally, in 1870.
Well, that's what can happen. We're going to a break, so I'll break in here and get this in. That's what can happen when you do have people broken up into little groups because they all want to have their own freedom of.
They didn't want that. The Germans didn't want that. It was just despotic rulers who wanted to have their own kingdom.
Okay.
The Germans wanted unification, but the rulers didn't want it.
Oh, that's good. I'm glad you said that.
Yeah. All right. So, and this time they had this one representative in the German parliament there who was one of the leading forces of getting Germany unified finally. And he was a baptized Jew, if that's possible, if you define Jews as an ethnic group and you baptize them, they're Christian. So anyway, And I was impressed by that. And then I learned about a number of other things that with the German nationalism that was coming up with that reunification, a lot of Jews became German nationalists as well. And those Jews who have lived in Germany for many hundred years. Now, that turned sour after the First World War when a lot of Eastern European Jews came to Germany who were not thinking German and they had their own agenda. And the original German Jews got there in a real bad place in Germany because they got blamed, too, for what was going on by those Eastern Jews.
Okay. All right. Well, we can continue with this if you want to. When we come back, ladies and gentlemen, we have only one more segment left. My goodness, it goes fast. But we'll be back in a few minutes.
We'll be right back with more on The Heretics Hour. You're listening to VOR, ReasonRadioNetwork.com.
John Eisbeet, thank you very much for being with us today. It's a pleasure, sir.
Thank you for having me.
So China has been a mystery for scholars throughout centuries. Why is it such a challenge for thinkers up till these days?
Up till these days? You think everything is revealed now?
It's still a challenge.
It's still a challenge. Well, it's, for thousands of years, it was such an insulated, isolated place that others didn't come in. And it's only been in recent years that a lot of people have traveled. I myself have been going there for 44 years, since 1967. But that's new for Westerners to spend so much time there. One or two did before, but now they're all over the place. Although I think the Western reporting is not very good about China, but there are a lot of people there. And my wife and I have been going there for the last 10 years. But it's still kind of a mystery. It's because of their language. It's because it's a country now with no ideology. And someone said the other day that history was the religion of China. And I think that's true, in a sense, that that's the only thing that really holds everything together now. Not the only thing. But, you know, they have that kind of reverence for their history, which they know so well through all of the dynasties and so on, and which the West has almost zero information about, and that's why it's a big mystery.
You've touched upon the ideology and the fact that China has no ideology, but how good is it to be a country without an ideology when you're striving to be a superpower? Is it just enough to send the message only about economic prosperity without any other ideology?
Well, there's some concern about that, but China didn't have an ideology before communism, really. They venerate Confucius, but that's not even a religion. It's kind of a code of living. So, and there are people searching in different directions. The United States, for example, doesn't have an ideology. There's the American dream and so on, but, you know, the people have all kinds of ideologies, all kinds of religious faiths and so on. They're all over the place. And I guess the only thing that holds everyone together is the idea that there's freedom in the United States and you can make of yourself what you can and so forth. And a little of that is involved now in China, too.
Here's another question. Everyone asks themselves, is China a socialism or is it a capitalism? I'm not even talking in terms of ideology, but in terms of a regime.
It's not socialism, but it's socialism with Chinese characters. Now, if you can figure out what that means, that would help a lot because no one knows what it means. It's not a socialist country. It's not a communist country. But, you know, here we're sitting.
Let's return to the Heretics Hour, brought to you by VOR, ReasonRadioNetwork.com. And now here's Carolyn.
Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen. My guest is Guillermo Rudolph, who has been giving us a lot of his positions on a number of issues, and he's been very good about answering everything that I ask. And I get into talking about the Jews, I want to just say a little bit more about that, if you will bear with me, and then we'll go on to another topic to finish off the program. And that is this list that was put out by CODA originally, and you have it on your website, which is the things that revisionists do not deny, or what they claim and what they don't claim, and so on. And I've seen this list before, and I find some fault with it. And the part that I find fault with starts with, we already talked about the other people who were persecuted during the war. Of course, they only talk about those who were persecuted in their view by the Germans, not any that other people persecuted, not the Germans being persecuted. But then we just also covered revisionists, you say, do not deny that the treatment of Jews was unjust. And I would argue that it was not unjust, given the behavior of Jews in the country, and particularly how involved Jews were in the defeat of Germany in the First World War, the forcing Germany to surrender when they should not have done so and didn't need to do so, and because of their unrest back home and the laborers to strike and so on. And then what was going on prior to World War II, and there's so much unpatriotic behavior by Jews, and the huge boycott, that worldwide boycott, and so on, all of that. But then it also says they deny the victims of the Holocaust, apparently, their dignity. And you say, no, they don't. We don't deny them their dignity. Well, of course, they're not denied that. They don't deny them to be remembered. No. But they deny to show compassion for the victims. Wrong, we don't deny that. Well, why should we be showing compassion, remembering, giving dignity, all of this, admitting that the treatment of Jews was unjust, all of this for the Jews in particular?
Let me start with some basics. I think that one of the major accomplishments of Western society, of if you wish, the white race, is that we have developed a concept of law that applies to individual guilt. So that you're not being held responsible of what any of your friends or relatives did, or co-religionists, or your compatriots, or whatever group is addressed. So when it comes to holding a Jew, no matter where I find him, responsible for what some other Jew or group of Jews has done somewhere else in the world or somewhere else in the country, is something that I find in crass violation of that principle, and therefore I cannot agree with it. If individual fault or guilt can be found in a Jew or a Gentile, whoever, having committed something that does damage to some other civil right or national right or whatever, then after a proper procedure, he can be punished, yes. But that's not what happened in Germany.
Well, that is what happened in many, many cases, because let's just say Jews, were found guilty of particular offenses, and they were put in camps for that reason. But they are, because of the narrative that's been accepted, they are all considered innocent and having been incarcerated unjustly, which is not true.
Well, there are, of course, in particular when we're talking about the case before the war, before the outbreak with of the war with the Soviet Union, there have been a lot of cases where people were sent to prisons or concentration camps because of proper crimes being sentenced in proper court. But I'm talking about persecutorial acts that we had before that, coming starting with the Nuremberg Laws in 35 and the inability to follow their profession, losing part of their property. And in particular, after 41, the Wenton arrests and put into ghettos and camps because they just belonged to a group, not because there was any individual guilt.
You know, you have to take responsibility for your group. If you're going to be a part of a group, what these people needed to have done was to stand up against what the group was doing, if the group was doing something.
Well, that's what they did in 33 and 34. The various Jewish groups in Germany spoke out vehemently against the atrocities.
Well, and they weren't harmed. They weren't harmed, those people.
No, initially not, but later on they were.
Well, things probably changed. And another thing about the Nuremberg Laws was that Jewish control in Germany, which during the Weimar regime, grew and grew. It was way overdone. And let's just move then to the United States. Can you deny that there is overpowering Jewish control in the United States today, which is not good for any American? And Jews who say, well, I'm not responsible for that, they don't speak up against it. They don't speak up against their fellow Jews for many, many crimes that they're committing and the way that they get into power.
That is a moral responsibility and a moral obligation, but it's something different than a legal and a penal obligation or a penal responsibility. I need to distinguish these two things. And no, I agree. There's overrepresentation of Jews in certain sectors of the American society. There can be no doubt about it. And whether or not someone wants to accept that, that could be made with an easy comparison to see whether it should be accepted. If we face a similar dominance in certain sectors of U.S. society by Muslims, there would probably be an insurrection against that.
Mm-hmm.
But when it's done by Jews, it's accepted willingly.
Yes.
Why that is a different issue. Now, the same thing was in Germany. Then they had an insurrection against it, and the methods they've applied, I don't think, were always in keeping with the legal principle. Now, you can say I'm against affirmative action as it is applied in the United States to get blacks into a similar percentage in professions as the whites are, because that's been happening over the past 30, 40 years. And that kind of affirmative action, if you're fair, should be applied to Jews too, in reverse. If you are for the one affirmative action, how could you be against the other? So if we have, say, in New York, 80% of all the lawyers Jewish, but only 20% of the population, shouldn't we get rid of 60%?
Mm-hmm.
If affirmative action is a good thing, it should be applied to everyone.
But if anybody says that, it doesn't matter who they are, they are called anti-Semitic. I mean, everything that is spoken,
yes.
That
but most
Jews
people, of course,
feel
right. That's right. But it's, of course, a misnomer, as you know, anti-Semitic, because that means being against Arabs, basically. But that's a different issue. Yeah, I agree. It's a hot topic. And should we be for or against affirmative action? I must say, I individually, personally, am against it. A person should be put in a job and in a position if he is capable of doing it, not because or he belongs to a certain group, has a certain skin color or not. If the educational standard of blacks is, for whatever reason, considerably lower than whites, then they should not be as represented as whites in positions that require higher education. It's that simple. If the same applies to Jews, Jews have on average a higher educational standard than non-Jews have, and the same applies there. Why shouldn't they have a higher share?
Because we know that Jews, once they get in positions of authority, they hire other Jews. They work very hard to get other Jews in similar positions or under them, and they build up the Jewish membership, and that is why there are now amazingly, we don't even know how much because people don't recognize who is a Jew, really. Only some of the more obvious ones. But they have amazingly high percentage in everything that is powerful or that is influential. They don't want to be highly represented in as farmers or as, you know, plumbers or something. They're highly influential and in high numbers in the powerful positions. And to pretend that it's because of their ability is just plain wrong. You know, I mean, I'm sure you agree with that. It's not all attributed to their ability.
No. Not all of it.
No.
But
And they don't even do a good job, because they do a job in the interests of the Jewish of the Jewish people, and often in the interests of worldwide Jewry, including Israel, and not in the interests of the American people.
If there is a conflict, a lot of them tend to do that. Yeah, not everything is in conflict with this, though. So,
yes, okay. I have you know, we were talking earlier this morning about this latest development, which you might take up now in Germany. Why don't you describe that, which kind of affects you in a little bit?
Yeah, I was actually first confronted with what's going on by you writing me an email about we Skyped about it. You dropped the email. Do you know about this person? And I was completely oblivious.
Yes, the terror cell.
Yeah. So I Googled it, and I quickly found out that apparently for many years there is or the authorities in Germany claim that there is a National Socialist underground movement that is considered to be a terrorist group that is suspected to have committed a series of murders and other violent acts in Germany. And I was completely oblivious of it. It must have started apparently while I was in prison. At the point, I didn't have in contrast to most inmates, I didn't have a TV and I didn't read any newspapers either. So I was cut off from that and didn't follow these news. So I was unaware. And even after I got out, as I mentioned before, I kind of keep a distance because it's just upsetting me. And, I read a little bit about it, but that didn't really bother me too much, because National Socialist terrorism in Germany, it's very rare, in contrast to left-wing terrorism, which we have a lot, not just in Germany. So it's a little bit of an exotic topic. But then accidentally I found in my spam folder an email just today in the morning of a guy that has been sending me stuff that I always put in my spam folder because I wasn't reading it. So I was there on purpose. But I found a message sent in by somebody who said that a certain Gerd Ittner had been arrested in Portugal, and that the German authorities, or according to the media, to some media reports, suspect him not only to be a Holocaust denier, or in proper language, a revisionist, but also that he has had some contacts with leading figures of that claimed terrorist group. Therefore, he was suspected to be supportive of them and somehow involved. And the name rang a bell. Gerd Ittner. I said, wait a minute. That I know that name. He has been a customer, maybe even. So I Googled my own website, or rather my former website. There's two. I have my personal one, gamarulov.com, and then the one that just has revisionist stuff on it. That's vho.org. And it's now controlled by other people due to my arrest in 2005. But it's still a good resource. So I went there and Googled whether I'd ever published anything. And I found that in my former German magazine, the guy had written an obituary of a friend of mine, a former history teacher. And he also had written two letters to the editor. And so I knew he was a customer. He was a contributor. So I realized what's going on here by the German media and the German authorities is that they try to make a link between National Socialist or claimed National Socialist terrorism and revisionism. Now, that's, of course, a very dangerous thing, because if they manage to make that link and accuse you because you have a certain historical viewpoint to at once be connected with terrorist groups, Germany, just like the United States, has also enacted after 9/11 certain laws that enable them to deny you certain civil rights and criminal procedures, to withhold secret evidence and what have you, all these kangaroo trial characteristics that we know. And so it's not a nice place to be there. I mean, even normal trials for revisionists, you're not allowed to introduce evidence to show that you're right and they can actually give your lawyer a gag order if he talks too much and other things. But compounded with terrorist charges, that would make it unbearable. So this one lady got arrested a while ago. She turned herself in, who is supposed to be the only surviving head of that terrorist group, and she's supposed to have been in contact at some point with that former contributor of mine. I thought, oh, my God, what's going on here? Reminded me of a statement that George Bush made in 2003, I think, when he was trying to justify the war against Iraq, and he was complaining that certain revisionist historians were trying to rewrite history and delegitimize the United States government waging of wars, and trying already back then to draw a line of revisionists. They are really supporters of terrorists. So there is a way of the German government and the media and the powers that be to tighten the thumb screws even a little bit more against revisionism by not just leaving it at the quote-unquote normal persecution by prosecution, but by turning up the heat and declaring them supporters, ideological supporters or whatever, of terrorists and thus of terrorists themselves. And that is a frightening development indeed.
Yes, yes, it could be. I don't see how they can make that link, but well, they have with him. And but to me, it seems like they're just looking for anyone that they can find who is in any way like on the right wing or not just a total communist, who that they can connect with this terror cell to make it seem like there really was a real terror cell. You know, that it was more than just these three people who they have really framed. I think. Two of them after they're dead, and this other woman they have in custody in prison, they can frame to be the criminals that they want to make them out to be, and now they're trying to tie as many other right-wingers, including revisionists, to that, to make it appear that they really have a case, which I think the whole thing is a total fraud.
Well, I could imagine a scenario where people in Germany get so pissed that after being unable to take it in anymore, to put up with it anymore, they turn violent. So I consider the possibility of something like that happening. I don't know what the situation is in that case, and we'll probably never find out, because I expect a lot of things to be rigged by secret services in Germany, which they've always done. They have a long track record of rigging crimes to stick it on right-wingers and left-wingers. I see that this is just another way of justifying new laws, justifying new measures of persecution, and to really increase the hysteria in the general populace that they are afraid of terrorists, so that the government gets away with these persecutorial measures. Now, of course, it is immediately used for another attempt to outlaw a right-wing oppositional party, some of whose members are also somehow around a couple of corners said to have been associated with that terrorist group. And more laws and more institutions and more teaching programs and historical enlightenment programs being set up and funding increased and state protection agencies and secret services getting more funding. And so you see what the real reason behind that is. It's just the government body of suppression and surveillance needing justification to increase its grip on the populace.
Well, that's right, and that's the way it's going in the United States and in Britain, every country. That is a factor that when people are making their living off of a certain industry, whether you know be secure in interior security and so on, that they don't have a problem with building it up and making it bigger and bigger and bigger, and that it's just amazing what people are capable of doing and just sort of hiding from themselves the rightness of what they're doing. It's just amazing. That's how all this stuff gets going. Let's talk for a minute. We just have a little bit of time left about free speech. Because I was asking you if if free speech is the solution to everything. I mean, I don't think it is, but you know, if we just enacted total free speech, well, that would be a good beginning. Would that be the solution, or do we need something further to understand something further than that?
Well, I think Bradley Smith once said, "What's free speech good for if you don't have a right to be listened?" No, I don't think that total free speech is a good thing, because if you could go out there and you know, we had that during the election of Obama when some black guys in certain caucuses would go out to the places where people are lining up to vote and threaten people, verbally only, but threaten people, if you don't vote for Obama, we're going to kill you. Mm-hmm. Total free speech would allow that. And I think there have to be limits. I don't know if anything ever happened to that black guy, maybe not because of political correctness, but it should have. Because as soon as you cross a certain borderline, that is to you advocate the restriction of other people's civil rights, that's the borderline you should not be allowed to cross. Now, I'm talking primarily about a moral borderline here. I'm not yet talking about a penal borderline, because a government going after people should be restricted as much as possible, and they should really be an immediate threat of harm. Like if somebody writes a academic paper that we should be allowed to torture people in custody of the CIA, that is an obvious violation of somebody's civil rights, advocation of violation of his civil rights. But since it's not causing any immediate danger, the question is whether or not that should be disallowed. But if you go out on the street and threaten somebody to kill if he doesn't vote for the kind of person you want him to vote, that is going beyond what should be acceptable. But free speech, as I said, is not the solution to everything, because we need a right to be heard. And that's the problem. If you have a country where the media, 98% of the mass media are controlled by 7 or 8 big corporations who are called by big corporate money, and they dictate, and you have basically advertising companies, 1 or 2 that have monopolized everything and thus are controlling basically these corporations indirectly, and you have a situation where even with all the free speech that the U.S. Constitution guarantees, and it's very liberal and the most liberal I think we have in the whole wide world, is no good, because you are not going to be heard if those media monopolies don't want you to be heard. And this is something that I have no solution to that right now. I couldn't say, give you a recipe of how to solve that problem, but it is something that has to be worked on. How do we get around?
Well, here's one way, because would you agree that the media, it's pretty well known, is controlled by Jewish interests, except for a very tiny little part of it. It's all the big media, we've got 2 minutes, all the big media conglomerates are in Jewish control and Jewish management, and many of the people that work there are Jewish. I mean, there's an instance where they are doing things that are harmful to the country that they live in, but they don't care, and they're the ones who are preventing our speech from getting out.
Yeah, there we have it again. You are monothematic, but you're right in a way that Jews are overrepresented in a lot of media. But that doesn't mean they are the only ones.
All right. Okay. But now the solution to that would be to pass some laws to say that these people cannot control our media, because this is very detrimental to a nation, to a democracy like the United States used to be. to have one group of people who have particular interests of their own to be in control of all of our communication. So this would be an area where what Hitler did in Nazi Germany would be the only way to go, and that is to break that up and say, you can't run all these things. We're taking it away from you.
It's, of course, a problem to meddle with free enterprises by forcing them to employ or unemploy certain people. But morally seen, you're right. But if you do something like that, you have to apply it equally. Nobody is allowed to be overrepresented. I would say what you always could do is the public broadcasting media have to have a equal representation of all the societal, ethnic, religious, whatever groups in the society, and have to get program shares accordingly. Now, okay. This is something you can do in public media, and in the private media, it's a little bit.
Okay, Guillermo, we have to stop here because I do want to say good night. It'll be good night to you, and I want to thank you so much for being my guest on this program. The music is coming right up, so thanks.
Yeah, thank you for having had me.
All right, it's been a great pleasure. Good night, everyone.
Good night.
Thanks for listening. The Heretics Hour returns Monday evening, 9 p.m. Eastern U.S. time. Join us at ReasonRadioNetwork.com.